Ground truth is a scientific term, and it was NASA that coined it. When NASA calibrates satellite imagery, they take two measurements, one from space and then one from a person on the ground. They call that human reading the ground truth. If the two measurements conflict, NASA says, trust the human reading. This is a podcast about human readings.
From WGBH in Boston, you're listening to Ground Truth, human stories from the front lines.
I'm Charles Sennett, founder of the Ground Truth Project. The human consequences of climate change are the focus of this season of Ground Truth. We begin our journey in one of the hottest, driest countries on Earth, Somalia. 25 years ago, famine and then civil war began to ravage this country in the Horn of Africa. The U.S. military came as part of a United Nations effort to help feed a starving nation, but soon it was clear they were helicoptering into a war, and they were part of it.
October 3rd, 1993 was a Sunday. 115 men leave on an operation planned to last 90 minutes, but they will not return for 17 hours. Flying low over the target area, the Black Hawk helicopter is shot down by a rocket-propelled grenade.
Eighteen American soldiers were killed in the ambush. The body of one soldier was dragged through the streets. A quarter century later, the war continues. Millions of Somalis have fled, many of them to Dadaab refugee camp in neighboring Kenya. It's grown into the largest refugee camp on Earth. But 10 million people are still living in Somalia, many as nomads and farmers, living and dying by the small amount of rain the country gets in a year. The droughts in Somalia are getting longer and more frequent. Scientists believe the impact of climate change has exacerbated environmental degradation and forced migration. Effects of climate change like these in Somalia are what the U.S. Defense Department calls a threat multiplier, fueling conflict and the extremism of terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab. Recent news reports indicate the U.S. is once again stepping up its presence in Somalia in a shadow war against the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab. Kenya-based journalists Laura Heaton and Nicole Sabeki have been reporting for Ground Truth over the last year on this connection between the environment and conflict. Laura starts this story in northern Somalia.
A murder happened here 2 weeks ago in this remote Somali community. It's not even a village, really, just several houses clustered near a well, surrounded by miles of barren terrain. The men sing in time as they heave up buckets of water for their animals. It's calm now, but Ali Youssef Adan, the cousin of the man who was killed, says the changing environment is making people desperate and pushing them to violence.
A decade ago, we had more rain than we needed. The climate was good and we didn't have a lot of conflict. But now the rains come less, and people have begun to fence off grazing land. If people fence off the communal land and we don't have much rain, conflict will always be a part of our life.
Ali takes us to a clearing close by where wind whips up huge clouds of dust. There's no grass here anymore. The one tree has a gaping chunk blown away, a splintery bullet hole.
Both men were coming from the well that morning with their animals. One of them hid along the path and shot the other dead.
The two men had been fighting over a small patch of pasture, some of the only vegetation left after a recent drought lasted several months. One of the men had been protecting the land and cultivating food for his goats and camels. The other one had just arrived in the area, and his animals were on the brink of starvation. This is the way that cycles of conflict start. They begin with competition over resources, water, pasture, trees, and they become about retaliation. We drive to a health clinic 20 minutes away that also functions as the mortuary. The medic who runs the clinic, Farah Arab, prepared the death certificate for the man who was shot. Farah says he's worried about the violence this killing might spark.
Cases like this are becoming more common, which worries me. The criminal escape easily. The victims pile up. What can we do? It's like a chain. It goes on and on.
For the past year, photojournalist Nicole Sobecki and I have been on a mission to understand how climate change and environmental degradation drive conflict in Somalia. It's a place where people are feeling the effects of climate change right now. Average temperatures are rising and rain falls less often and in smaller amounts. Drought experts estimate that average rainfall is down about 15%. Now, that wouldn't make much difference if you live in a place like Seattle or London. But in Somalia, a mostly desert country where people make the most from the few inches of rain they get, every little bit counts. Somalia is a country of nomads, pastoralists, people who live and die migrating to places where they can find pasture and water for their animals. But people told us they're being forced to move farther and farther away from their typical routes. And as water sources and pastureland dry up, many Somalis are being pushed out of their homeland altogether, over borders and across seas. 5 years ago, a famine left 250,000 Somalis dead and forced nearly 300,000 to flee the country.
So I'm betting will vanish from the earth. Somalis will vanish from Somalia.
Maybe that's environmental activist Fatima Jibril. After Somalia's government collapsed in 1991, she foresaw environmental disaster and started an organization now called Adesso. It focuses on helping nomadic families preserve the natural resources their lives depend on. But she's losing faith it will work in the long run.
The pastoral way of life is at risk. It cannot sustain. And you know what? It's not going to vanish only due to drought. It's going to vanish due to drought that will bring wars. Because we'll fight like chicken with a small amount of crumbs. We'll eat each other alive. Because this environment is not giving us anymore. That's how it's going to end up.
Many Somalis are leaving Somalia, driven out by drought, by famine, by violence, crossing the border into neighboring countries like the one where Nicole and I live, Kenya. We pack our bags for Dadaab, Kenya, home of the largest refugee camp in the world. More than 300,000 Somalis live in Dadaab, in crowded makeshift houses, some of them since the start of the civil war 25 years ago. The mornings start early here, with the call to prayer before sunup. Outside a food distribution center, women set up tea stands and kiosks selling breakfast breads. Men walk by with their donkeys and carts for hire. Children in uniforms hurry by on their way to school, and other kids, usually from families who can't afford the uniforms and books, gather at the madrasa, the local religious school. We have to move around with a Kenyan police escort, and they don't want us to stay anywhere for more than 30 minutes. There have been a few kidnappings, most recently a Kenyan teacher last year. And the Somali border is just 50 miles away, so it wouldn't take long to get whisked out of Kenya and into the hands of Al-Shabaab. One of the refugees we meet in the Dadaab camp is Mohammed Abukar. He welcomes us through his family's front gate just as their day is starting. Their home here is like a typical Somali homestead, several dome structures built of wooden frames covered with a patchwork of tarps and cloth. One hut is the living room, another the family bedroom, and a smaller one is the kitchen. There's a pen for the goats, surrounded by thorn bushes. This morning, Mohammed's wife Habiba is making a breakfast of flatbread and tea. In the living room hut, the dirt floors are swept flat and clean. We sit with Mohammed on plastic mats.
I fled from Somalia for two reasons: insecurity and drought that devastated the livestock and the farm. The farm used to produce maize, sorghum and sesame. Even watermelon can grow. It used to be a farm that relied on seasonal rains. But when the drought hit, everything got destroyed. When I was fleeing, I encountered a lot of challenges. We trekked for 27 days. Al-Shabaab guys arrested and detained us for 5 days. They didn't want us to leave.
Al-Shabaab is an extremist group tied to Al-Qaeda. The militants took control of large parts of the country starting in the mid-2000s, and today claim thousands of square miles across Somalia. They enforce Sharia law and run training camps for foreign fighters. They regularly launch attacks in Somalia, and more recently they've ventured into neighboring Kenya, starting with the Westgate Mall attack that killed about 70 people. Mohammed came to Dadaab refugee camp in 2011 with Habiba and two daughters. They now have 5 young children whose futures they worry about. Mohammed can't see how they'll ever return to Somalia. He's terrified his children will be recruited by Al-Shabaab.
I don't want my children to even leave an area where they see guns or fighting. You saw the little boy. What happens if he ends up at the hands of bad people? So I don't want them to experience such life.
Mohammed says that in Somalia, Al-Shabaab recruits boys at the madrasas, and parents have little power to counter that influence.
I am fearful they will be recruited. First, there is no school other than those run and controlled by them. The other thing is they can radicalize you because you are poor and don't have anything.
And his daughters? The boys and girls are not different, he says. The girls will be forcibly married to Al-Shabaab fighters. He adds that humanitarian organizations are blocked from Al-Shabaab-controlled areas.
The reason they banned all the aid agencies that would have helped the people is to attract the hungry people, knowing too well that people facing starvation will fall for anything. The worst is the drought, because with something to eat, you can tolerate jail or any punishment. But facing starvation is worse than insecurity.
Al-Shabaab's offers of protection, food, and money can be powerful. Somalia's top environmental official, Buri Hamza, talked with us about this in May. He made the connection between extremism and Somalia's environmental problems, problems that are getting worse with climate change.
And the fact that many of our youth have lost jobs because of desertification, deforestation. It's not the only cause, of course, of radicalization, but this is one of the major causes of radicalization because of the linkages between, you know, violence and environmental degradation.
Hamza said the Ministry of Environment has a fraction of the budget it needs. He said that it's difficult to get other Somali government officials and international donors to focus on environmental protection. Basic security in the country is still the most pressing problem. When Nicole and I were in Mogadishu, we had to drive around in an armored car and had 2 pickup trucks full of armed guards with us all the time. But despite the risks, Hamza moved back to Mogadishu in 2012 from Canada, while his wife and 2 children stayed safely behind. He traveled frequently to try and attract attention and money to fund environmental projects. Hamza's pitch was polished, but he admitted it was hard to get people on board.
I want to emphasize this. You know, unless we really look into the underlying causes of conflict, I don't really think that we will be able to bring about a lasting solution.
A month after our interview, members of Al-Shabaab detonated a car bomb outside a Mogadishu hotel and stormed the building, shooting people and taking hostages. Fifteen people were killed in the attack, including Bari Hamza. Nicole and I want to hear from someone who can talk personally about the lure of radicalization, someone who was drawn into that life and joined Al-Shabaab. But it's going to take some serious planning. A local journalist in Dadaab, who also works as our translator, is willing to help. I'll call him Yusuf. For reasons I'll explain, it's not safe to use his real name. He came to the camp as a five-year-old when his family fled Mogadishu at the start of the civil war, 25 years ago.
You know, working as a journalist here in the camp, it's a bit difficult. You know, there were so many journalists who were being killed in Somalia. So that had affected me here in the camp also.
Journalists are regularly targeted and murdered in Somalia. His mother worried about his safety, asked him to stop this work. Become a businessman or something, she would say. My mother, you know, but Yusuf says journalism, to him, is not just a job.
You know, it's not only because of work, it's because of passion. I really like it. I like writing, I like, you know, reporting. But
the work comes at a cost, and at times he's had to stop reporting in the face of threats. He's been called an infidel, a spy for the Americans.
And in reality, I was just a refugee who was just willing to work as a journalist.
As a journalist, Yusuf has been able to track down a few former Al-Shabaab militants in the refugee camp. But he's never been able to get any of them to talk on the record, and he's tried, for years. Contacting former Al-Shabaab fighters is dangerous, both for the former fighters and for Yusuf. And that's why we're not using his real name. He could be targeted by Kenyan authorities or even Al-Shabaab itself. Nicole and I have coffee with Yusuf at a restaurant on the main road in Dadaab town and make a plan. He's been trying to convince two former Al-Shabaab members to talk with us.
One was saying that he's even fearing his life. You know, he was sent to a mission in Somalia to fight, but he has ditched and walked away to the camp. And at the other time, he's saying that, you know, if the Kenyan government knows about that I was a former, then I'll have another problem. So he said that I'm on fire on both ends.
Do you think that they would be more willing to talk to you, or is it the idea of being recorded at all?
That's my reporting partner, Nicole.
So is it us that's the problem because we're foreigners coming in here, or is it just the idea of being recorded at all?
It is both. It's both because, you know, the trust is the problem here.
Sure.
The problem is the trust, not me interviewing or you interviewing or recording or taking a picture of him. The problem is that, you know, this fear in the community, fear from the Kenyan government, fear that, you know who you are talking to.
Trust is at an all-time low in Dadaab. The Kenyan government is claiming the refugees pose a terrorist threat, and the refugees say some Somalis have been disappeared by masked members of the Kenyan anti-terror police unit. A Kenyan official admitted to us that some police abuse their power and kill Somalis they suspect of being connected to Al-Shabaab, but he said those police are prosecuted if they're caught.
I did everything, but they said, no, my friend, this day's life is not good. And he told me, like, I trust you, but, like, how should I trust them? He said that they might be an FBI agent or they might be a CIA.
This is just one idea. Do you think you could go interview them? We could give you the recording equipment and the three of us could talk through what questions, but maybe you could just go meet him?
I'll have to go back and try. The only thing, I was just trying to convince them so that, you know, the only way they can meet you. But he said no.
Well, it seems like we should Maybe we should plan out the questions and you should take the recorder with you, because I think if you sit with him and you say, like, okay, like, can we just talk, the two of us, maybe you can just ask him the questions there. Cause
I think that will be simple, I think, I hope.
We brainstorm a bunch of questions, and I write them in a notebook for Yusuf to translate and take to the interview.
Yeah. Let me see if I can read.
You can read my writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Laura has pretty good handwriting.
Will you describe your farm crops?
We only want you to go as far with this plan as you feel comfortable. So if at any point you are worried about your security, it doesn't feel right to you, we completely understand and we trust your instinct, so you should stop at any point if it doesn't feel.
No, I'll assess the situation, and if I feel that it's not good for either me or him, then I need to stop it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yusuf goes to meet the former Al-Shabaab fighter. We wait by the phone. About an hour later, he calls us to say the man won't answer the questions. We urge Yusuf to stay to see if the man opens up once he gets more comfortable. He does. The next day, we play back the recording of the interview, and Yusuf translates. The former Al-Shabaab fighter doesn't want his name used in our reporting, so we'll call him Khalid. He's around 30 years old, and Yusuf said he's thin, with a short beard and a cool demeanor. Yusuf had the clever idea of doing the interview while driving around in his friend's taxi so that they would have privacy and not be seen in the camp together. They had the window down, so sometimes the wind is pretty strong in the tape.
Some good days have passed us because we used to grow mangoes, and during the harvest we used to eat the mangoes, and some other, you know, vegetables were grown in the farm. But at last, something bad had happened, and that is the drought. And, you know, I was working hard, and the farm was a little bit okay. But the last days, it was like, you know, the farm was not producing well. And I consulted some of my friends and family members, and I decided to join them.
Them, he's referring to Al-Shabaab.
I joined them in 2008, and that time, like, you know, they were used to take a third of the harvest. When I joined them, like, there were no more taxation imposed against me, and I felt, you know, I felt like, you know, I'm now, how should I put this, like he was saying, I feel like I'm now, you know, a blessed person, because I have
some, a blessed person.
Yeah. Because I have enough things to eat.
So Khalid joined Al-Shabaab to keep that portion of his harvest, choosing extremism for himself over starvation for his family. Like Buri Hamza told us before he died, this is how environmental problems, worsened by climate change, are fueling radicalization. Yusuf didn't talk to Khalid about the crimes he committed as a militant. Khalid wouldn't discuss it. But during the 2 years he was part of Al-Shabaab, the group was responsible for extortion, terror attacks, and recruitment of child soldiers. Yusuf keeps translating.
Before the drought, things were okay, and we lived in a good life. Like, there was enough produce of farming, and everybody was happy in the village where I lived, but it was this combination of the drought and these bad guys who had come.
Which he joined.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, you know, you said that he referred to Shabaab as the bad guys that came.
That's what he was saying, yeah.
And I wonder what that means in the context of him having joined Shabaab and been a part of them for 2 years.
The reason he joined them was because, not because he loved the ideology or and he loved them, but it was because, you know, it was to safeguard his farm's harvest. The only way he can save his produce was joining them so that he avoids being taxed.
With climate change, periods of drought are becoming more frequent and severe. Khalid's town is still controlled by Al-Shabaab. So what would prevent him from joining up again if he is forced to go back? It's that fear of becoming desperate again that stops many refugees in Dadaab from returning to Somalia. This is what keeps Mohammed, the father of five, up at night. In the end, he may not have a choice. The Kenyan government has drawn up plans to close the camp and has started making all refugees register, calling it a verification process, to plan when they'll go home. But for a huge segment of the camp's population, people like Yusuf, Dadaab is the only home they've ever known. Before we leave Dadaab, we go with Yusuf to visit Mohammed's house one last time. When we first met Mohammed a few months ago, he told us his neighbors had started registering to go back to Somalia.
They are all gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a few months' time, Mohammed will be lonely.
Yeah. Yeah, they've gone back. Now, many of the houses in his row have been dismantled. Rickety gates lead to empty plots, a stray shoe left behind.
Since people in the block started moving back, I have sleepless nights and worry a lot. I'm even worried that I can get high blood pressure because of thinking a lot.
Apart from the threat of Al-Shabaab, Mohammed doubts he could make a life in Somalia as a farmer. He no longer has farming equipment or money for seeds, and his land has likely been taken over by others. And he hears from friends who have gone back that the drought persists. You can no longer rely on the rains. Starving terrifies him even more than Al-Shabaab.
Even if Somalia has security problems, if someone has to die, it's best if he dies while in good shape, other than dying of hunger.
Mohammed walks with us back to our car. He asks if we have any ideas for him, a way out for him and his family. Militants or local militias still control huge swaths of Somalia. Al-Shabaab continues to wage hostile attacks against civilians, and the U.S. has ramped up its covert operations against the insurgency. Mohammed could try to make it to North America or Europe, but less than 1% of refugees in Dadaab get resettled to those places each year. Staying in Kenya is possible, but it's illegal and it's expensive. The going rate for a Kenyan ID card is about $2,000 per person, paid to corrupt officials. Mohammed only makes about $60 a month when he works for the Red Cross. So while Nicole and I fly home, refugees like Mohammed are biding their time, waiting for some breakthrough that brings more security to Somalia. Tragically, though, the factors driving the instability, including climate change, show no signs of letting up.
That was Ground Truth reporting fellow Laura Heaton. This episode of Ground Truth was produced by Rachel Rohr, Nicole Sabecki, Marissa Miley, and Nathan Toby. Sound design by Robert Anderson. Special thanks to Tom Devlin, Phil Rado, Bob Kemp, and Doug Sugarts at WGBH, and to PBS Frontline for archival audio from Somalia. I'm Charles Sennett, the executive editor. Join us next time on Ground Truth.